Epidemic. It's a powerful word. It makes reference to the widespread prevalence of disease upon a population. And for most of us here today, it refers to something that simply happens to somebody else, somewhere else. But I'd like to tell you, today there is an epidemic that has very quietly arisen, of which very few people are even aware, that will ultimately affect us all. According to Google Earth, we are here. But for the last 6 months, our attention has been focused here on West Africa, on three of the poorest countries in the world. As the outbreak of Ebola unfolded, we have daily monitored the number of cases and the case fatalities. And the images coming out of West Africa have been both very frightening and have evoked a very deep sense of empathy, because Ebola, in many ways, is very consistent with our preconceived notions of the serious health conditions affecting the developing world. We typically see these to be strange infectious diseases caused by exotic parasites, rare viruses, and malignant bacteria. But Ebola has reminded us that the global population is, in fact, very interconnected, and anything that affects one part of that population will affect it all. Now, there are many faces of global health. For some, it may be this 5-year-old boy suffering from malaria in Zaire, or this teenage Haitian girl who is orphaned by cholera. It may be this young mother in Tanzania who seeks counseling for the malnutrition of her infant. Or perhaps this young wife who seeks help with family planning in Niger. Now, the needs of these people have simply not gone away, but a new epidemic is now visible. This is an epidemic of, perhaps you could help me advance the slides. There we go. This is an epidemic of people dying of cardiogenic shock, like this 35-year-old woman in Bhutan, and this 48-year-old gentleman dying of lung cancer in Nepal, of this 10-year-old boy dying of Eisenmenger syndrome from an uncorrected BSD in Nicaragua, or this 55-year-old father of five dying of uncorrected aortic stenosis in Congo. These patients simply represent a new face in global health, and all of these patients are part of an epidemic of non-communicable diseases. Non-communicable diseases, or NCDs for short, account for 60% of all deaths worldwide. In 2013, 35 million people in the world died of non-communicable diseases, and 80% of those people died in developing countries. That means in 2013, 28 million people died of non-communicable disease in the third world. Sorry, the slides are still kind of slow. 90% of all deaths from COPD occur in developing countries. In high-income countries, 90% of all childhood leukemias are curable today, but in low-income countries like Guatemala, where this young girl was born, 90% of such cases are fatal. 90% of all children in the world born with congenital heart disease have no access to correction. The people of developing countries are not dying primarily of strange infectious diseases. They are dying of non-communicable diseases, diseases that are not transmitted from one person to the next. And the leading cause of these deaths is cardiovascular disease. It accounts for just under half of them. It's been driven by rampant rheumatic heart disease and congenital heart disease, and now more recently ischemic heart disease. 13% of these deaths are caused by chronic pulmonary conditions, especially tuberculosis and in particular MDR, TB. 19% of these deaths are caused by cancer, and the single major source of cancer is lung cancer. And the single leading cause of cancer death is also lung cancer. We in this room understand these diseases very well. They are, in fact, surgical diseases of the chest, cardiac and thoracic surgical diseases. We treat them successfully every day, but in developing countries, that treatment is lacking. And as a result, people are dying of these diseases, and they're dying prematurely, typically under the age of 60 years. Because of this, non-communicable diseases are devastating the populations of the developing world. Let me show you what I mean. This is a population pyramid of the United States in the year 2012. The age of the population rises vertically. The significance of these data is this. The age of the population is very stable until approximately the average age of 70, at which point it does begin to decline. High-income countries like the United States can be very productive because they have the population base to be so. Now, in contrast, this is a population pyramid of sub-Saharan Africa in the year 2012. Note, the age of the population rapidly declines after the age of 10 years. The significance of these data are simply this. The population dies prematurely. And because of these premature deaths, the workforce of the population, those people aged 17 to 60 years, simply vanishes. No country can expect to be productive without its workforce. Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the United States, recently described NCDs as a public health emergency in slow motion. Now, it's true. World mortality has fallen over the last 45 years, primarily as a result of a decline in premature deaths. But these data are very misleading, and let me explain. There are 195 countries in the world, and the World Bank stratifies them as a function of income, low, middle, and high-income countries. Middle-income countries are further divided into lower, middle, and upper middle-income countries. Gross national income per capita of less than 4,000 years characterizes the poorest countries in the world, those with a gross national income per capita of less than $4,000. These are the developing countries of the world. And premature death rates are directly related to the income of a country. Yes, in high-income countries since 1990, premature death rates have declined, particularly over the last decade. But in upper middle income countries, the death rate is approximately the same. It may be trending downward just a little bit. And in low income and low middle income countries, the death rate is rapidly accelerating. In 2013, 8 million people in developing countries died of premature death from non-communicable diseases. And in 2015, that number will be 10 million. Since 1990, the premature death rate from cardiovascular disease alone has risen in almost every single developing country on Earth. It's risen 100% in countries like Kenya, Pakistan, Philippines, 200% in Ghana, Afghanistan, and Bangladesh. Over that same time interval, the premature death rate from lung cancer has increased by 50% in countries like Vietnam and Myanmar. It's doubled in Guinea, Pakistan, and Indonesia. And it's not just the mortality from these diseases, it's the morbidity as well, the disability that is inflicted on the population of the developing world. One-third of all disability in the developing world comes from non-communicable diseases. And 80% of this is consolidated into the younger segments of the population. Again, those people under the age of 60. This combined mortality and morbidity of these diseases create effects that are rippling throughout the populations of these countries. And these effects are protean. They occur at the micro level as well as the macro level. Individuals that die prematurely or become disabled are far more likely to have children that likewise die prematurely. These people are poor. And the expenses of trying to provide health care is driving them further and further into poverty. There's really no concept of health insurance in the third world. All health care costs come straight out of pocket, especially those for medications. And for households, these costs can be simply unbearable. The cost of caring for a loved one in India with chronic heart failure may require 40% of a family's monthly budget. The care of an insulin-dependent diabetic child in sub-Saharan Africa consumes at least 60% of a family's annual income. This epidemic is simply overwhelming the fledgling health systems that are even in existence. These systems are struggling to provide acute care for infectious diseases. They simply don't have the financial resources to provide chronic care for non-communicable diseases. For example, the financial resources available to treat all low and middle income countries combined, a population of 5.7 billion people, is far less than the resources available to care for the 246 million people of Canada, UK, France, and Germany. These effects are manifest in the national economics of these countries. The loss of a productive labor force, of course, means the loss of tax revenue at a time when expenditures for health and welfare are rapidly rising. Together, these erode the institutional capacity of these countries, and the countries simply become non-competitive. And all the while, pressure from the population rises over unmet needs. These effects in turn ripple into the regional and global effects, because the health of these developing countries continues to decline, the health of the world simply continues to get worse. It leads to political stability, both internationally and nationally. Think back to 2013 and the riots that spread across the country of Brazil. Those riots were sparked over the huge financial investment that country made to attract the World Cup. But the underlying cause of those riots was anger and frustration over unmet social needs. And the principal source of anger was frustration over a lack of health care in that country. These effects further ripple into a loss of international trade and development. The Council on Foreign Affairs now estimates that over the next two decades, non-communicable diseases will inflict $21 trillion in losses in developing countries alone. But the effect on the global economy will be far worse. Economists are now projecting that over that same time period, the global economic losses will be $47 trillion. That is roughly 75% of global GDP, and it's a figure that far exceeds the total global losses of the recent financial crisis. Now, given the magnitude of this problem, it's appropriate to ask, what is driving this epidemic? Some have postulated It's a function of increased life expectancy in the developing world, now allowing the populations to manifest these diseases. Let's come back to this slide for one second. It is true that as life expectancy has risen, as premature death rates have fallen over the last 45 years. But the real difference between these curves is here, actually in early childhood. In 1960, the chance that a child born in a developing country would die before the age of 6 years was at least 20%. And the leading causes of death were perinatal death, largely as a result of obstetrical complications, malnutrition, and most importantly, infectious diseases. And so it was very appropriate that initial ventures into global health were focused on those three areas. Large numbers of programs were launched by thousands of agencies in order to address this. Many programs were focused on lowering perinatal mortality by teaching young midwives to wash their hands. Large programs were established to immunize young children against vaccine-preventable diseases. Programs were launched to vaccinate the population of children and young adults against meningitis and other infectious diseases. And mosquito netting was distributed in areas endemic of malaria. As I mentioned, thousands of agencies have been involved with this for the last 35 years. These are simply examples of three of the largest and most prominent. Their activities have been extremely ambitious and very productive. For example, by the end of 2015, over 600 million children will have been vaccinated against infectious diseases since the year 2000. Since 1988, 2.5 billion children have been immunized against polio. By 2013, well over 6 million adults were actively receiving antiretroviral agents. And over 360 medicated mosquito nettings have been distributed to combat malaria. Efforts such as these have been successful in lowering child mortality in the developing world. It's now projected that in the year 2035, child mortality of every country on Earth will be as low as it was in the United States in the year 1980, the year these efforts actually began. But the death from non-communicable diseases in low and low middle-income countries far exceeds the mortality from infectious diseases. So we can't simply explain this epidemic as a function of greater life expectancy. The World Health Organization has begun to take this problem under advisement. They've identified these risk factors as important in driving this epidemic. Now, everyone here today recognizes the importance of these particular risk factors. Each must be recognized and each must be effectively dealt with. But the underlying root cause behind all of these is far more significant and it's more difficult to address. The root cause is urbanization. Urbanization in the developing world confines populations into environments that is breeding NCDs. And it's doing so in countries that simply can't take care of the problem. And the world is urbanizing at an explosive rate. In 1950, there were only 746 million urbanites on Earth. And in 2014, there were almost 4 billion. Urbanization is galloping through the developing world at a rate of between 1 and 2% per year. It's now projected that in the year 2035, 60% of the entire global population will be an urbanite. Urbanites are far more likely to smoke, and tobacco companies know this. There are very few, if any, legal restraints against tobacco usage in the developing world. As a result of that, the consumption of cigarettes has tripled since 1980. In fact, today, 80% of all tobacco company profits are derived from the developing world. Supermarkets are proliferating in these new urban environments, like this one in Zaire. With these supermarkets have come changes in local diet, from one that has been based traditionally on grains, fruits, and vegetables, to one that is heavily laden with processed foods. These dietary changes have driven an explosion in diabetes in these populations. These dietary changes are also superimposed on some of the saltiest diets on Earth. This is particularly true in Asia and countries such as Tibet. Collectively, these have now made hypertension absolutely rampant. In almost every low and middle-income country on Earth, at least 45% of the population has significant hypertension. Urbanization is actually occurring not in the huge cities, as one may imagine. It's occurring in the cities with populations of less than 500,000 people. And the rapid influx of people is simply outstripping the capacity of these small to mid-sized cities. The populations are forced to live in densely crowded environments. And the result is slums. Over 1 billion people in the developing world are slum dwellers. Waterways traverse these slums like irrigation ditches that are actually trash-filled sewers and breeding grounds for disease. There are no air quality standards in the developing world, and the outdoor air in these densely packed urban environments is often simply unbreathable. And the indoor air quality is little better. Over 3 billion people still use open flames for indoor heating and cooking. Now, these NCDs, these non-communicable diseases, are very serious diseases. They're driven by very serious factors. They will require a very serious financial investment to correct them. But if one looks at the entire international budget for global health, it comes to about $27 to $28 billion per year. It comes from a variety of sources, as you can see on this graph. And over the first decade of the 2000s, it rose steadily every year. But it plateaued in 2008, and it's been very constant since that time. Today, a higher and higher percentage each year of voluntary contributions towards these efforts are required from non-governmental agencies. As one simple example, the entire budget of the World Health Organization is just under $4 billion per year, and 76% of that comes from voluntary donations. The leading voluntary donor is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. But the United States government has been and continues to be the largest source of international funding for global health. The amount of money in the U.S. federal budget for this rose every year throughout the Bush administration and has been very stable since then. It's important to note that this part of the U.S. federal budget has consistently received bipartisan support regardless of the polarization of the United States Congress. In 2013, the most recent data available, just over half of the U.S. budget for global health went to treat HIV/AIDS, and another large percentage went to treat malaria and maternal and child health. Virtually none of it, only $10 million out of an $8.4 billion budget, was directed towards the treatment of non-communicable diseases. In fact, one half of the disease burden, combined mortality and morbidity, in the developing world comes from NCDs, non-communicable diseases. And that's five times more than malaria, HIV, AIDS, and TB combined. And yet those three conditions receive 40% of all international aid in the world. And funding for NCDs, as you can see, is almost non-existent. In fact, across the world of developing countries, international aid directed towards non-communicable diseases averages 20 cents per disability life-adjusted year. A far greater investment is required. This epidemic first became visible in 1990, but throughout the 90s and early 2000s, it was simply overshadowed by HIV/AIDS. That's where all the international funding has gone. But the world is now finally beginning to notice. At the request of a group of low-income countries, this issue was brought before the General Assembly of the United Nations in September of 2011. That's actually very significant because the only other health issue to ever be taken under advisement by the General Assembly of the United Nations is HIV/AIDS. And as a result of this presentation in 2011, the World Health Organization, led by Dr. Margaret Chan, has now commissioned the Global Action Plan for the Prevention and Control of NCDs, a plan to cover the 7 years between 2013 and 2020. Now, this is a very ambitious plan, but it's only just now gotten underway. It seeks to lower mortality from NCDs by 25% by 2020. And it seeks to do so through these measures of prevention. Everyone here today understands and values prevention. But as surgeons, we also understand that these measures alone will simply be insufficient to address the problem. In their essence, these are diseases that the diseases that are causing this epidemic are diseases of the chest. And as such, they require surgery to provide effective treatment. The president of the World Bank agrees. In a speech delivered in January of 2014, very recently, Dr. Jim Yong Kim said the following: 2 to 3 billion people are shut out of the operating world. The world's poorest countries have 70% of the people, but only a quarter of the operations occur there each year. I urge you to challenge this injustice and to build a shared vision and strategy for world equity and essential surgical care. He went on to challenge us to make the case that surgery is an indivisible and indispensable part of healthcare. The gauntlet has been thrown. 14 years ago, in his presidential address to the AATS, here in San Diego, as a matter of fact, Dr. Jim Cox provided us with a vision for a more equitable distribution of cardiothoracic surgical care around the world. Many accepted that challenge, and great work has been done. I cannot do justice by listing all of it, but I want to note one example that I think illustrates the impact that can be made. Chip and Sia Bowman, along with their colleagues, made a commitment several years ago to bring cardiac surgery to Rwanda. They've been extremely productive, very successful, and have clearly made a difference. Perhaps they don't even appreciate just how big a difference they have made. Rwanda is one of the very few countries in the developing world that has actually seen a decline in premature deaths from cardiovascular disease. And it's simply no coincidence that Chip and Sia Bowman and their colleagues have been there. Rwanda, the country that was almost ruined by genocide just 20 years ago, now has a future and it has a future that began with the health of its people. Our specialty is now ready to make impact like this around the world. Today, this becomes an important core value for this organization, and we stand ready to lead. There are many very, very talented and dedicated people that are eager to contribute. I need to mention two in particular. We have many friends in other specialties, other professions, and in industry who share this desire to make a difference. In his role as president of the TSFRE, John Calhoun is playing an absolutely essential role in crystallizing these relationships to help bring this to fruition. Effective this meeting, Dr. Joe Duraney has assumed the leadership of a special task force to coordinate these efforts and bring them to fruition. There is clearly a great deal of work to do. I am confident that we can do this together. And there's only one way to do it, and that is in the words of my mother, who would simply say, "Let's begin." Thank you all very much. It's been my pleasure to serve as your president. Thank you.